How important is the Supreme Court in this upcoming presidential election? We're going to talk about that right now with Dr. Alex McFarland, who's a religion and culture expert. He's the author of 17 books, including his latest one called Stand Strong America, which he co-wrote with Jason Jimenez. Alex is the director of Christian Worldview and Apologetics at the Christian Worldview Center of North Greenville University. He's also co-host on a radio show of the American Family Association, which is syndicated nationally. And his website is alexmcfarland.com. Alex, welcome back to the program. And so how important is the Supreme Court when it comes to this coming presidential election and all the other elections, too? Because after all, the Senate has to approve the choices that the president will nominate.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. It's always an honor, and I have such a respect for you as a scholar and a broadcaster. But it is vitally important that people vote. I, Jerry, really view voting as a sacred trust that the Lord has allowed us in His providence, has allowed us to be born in a country where we can actually, with the ballot box, we can have an influence in the direction of our country. And so one of the things that we've witnessed in our lifetime is what some have called an activist judiciary. And the Supreme Court has really, as the late Antonin Scalia observed, become almost a legislative body. Scalia, before he passed, talked about the fact that unelected lawyers are really charting the legal and judicial course of the land and therefore the cultural future of America. And so the next president, whoever it is, will nominate 2, 3, and maybe 4 Supreme Court justices. So we're talking about things like religious freedom. We're talking about the sanctity of human life. We're talking about Second Amendment rights to gun ownership and thus self-defense. We're talking about things like terrorism, and we're talking about accountability within the government. In the last 4 years, we've seen a lot of corruption within the Department of Justice, and really some believe the DOJ right now is actually very unjust. And so there, because of the role that the Supreme Court has found itself playing in American life and politics, it is vitally important what types of Supreme Court justices are nominated, and the way that we can have a direct influence on that is by getting out and participating in the choice of the next president.
Hmm. All right. First of all, I'm wary when it comes to statistics because I don't know to believe all of them and so forth. But you hear all these horror statistics about how few evangelicals vote or how many choose not to vote and so forth. And I'm not going to ask you for a statistic because I don't even believe it necessarily. But here we go. That sounds terrible, Alex. I know.
No, but I understand what you mean.
Yeah,
I really do.
Yeah, I think we need to be wary. I mean, I hear these horror stories related to marriage and people get that kind of issue wrong. But here we go. As far as Christians and voting, we certainly know that there are sizable numbers of evangelicals who, for whatever reason, choose not to vote. I'm even hearing this year there are people who are so displeased with the two leading candidates on both sides, so they'll be talking about maybe some third party or write-in or something like that. Who knows? Maybe they'll even write in Jesus Christ or whatever, the only perfect person ever to live. But they have to realize, you know, it's going to be one or the other. It's going to be Clinton or it's going to be Trump. And there's a stark difference when it comes to these two. So let me ask you this question. Some that have said, I'm not going to vote for Trump because I don't agree with his character. And therefore, even when he promises that he would appoint justices like Scalia, how do we know we can trust Trump's promises? Your comment.
Well, great question, because that is one of the hotly debated topics. How many Christians, evangelicals, church members, you know, use the nomenclature of your choice, but how many Christians will vote? Because the estimates are that of those that espouse a biblical worldview, there may be 65 million. There may be as many as 130 million. So this is a huge voting block, and the candidates on all sides are aware of this and would like to engage this huge amount of the electorate. You know, I've heard, as you said, maybe only one out of five Christian votes, or maybe one out of three. Barna, I was on a phone call 2 weeks ago with George Barna of the Barna Research Group, and this year, because both candidates have negatives in the minds of so many voters, Barna estimates that maybe 44 to 56% of that 65 to 130 million you know, headcount of believers are not going to vote. Now, only the Lord knows, only the Lord knows. But to those that would be like a pastor in Texas, last week I was in Texas, and that's where I got the sinus infection. I apologize, that sounds so hoarse. But a pastor said to me that he was going to write in King Solomon, because Solomon was the wisest man in the Bible, and we need wisdom. And I understand the spirit in which things like that are said. I get it. I mean, in the millennium, Jesus will rule and reign. But right now, we've got, you know, humans leading. And I would say that really, it's a waste of your vote. And voting is a stewardship issue. I really do believe that. To write in, it might feel good just momentarily, or to not vote and say, well, you know, I'll make my voice heard. This is going to be the lowest voter turnout in our adult lives, perhaps. No, that's a waste. I mean, and here's the thing. As, you know, undesirable as many might think both of the candidates or either one of the candidates are, I mean, we are talking about not just personalities, but really two different platforms. As Mike Pence said in Pennsylvania last week, I think he was in Pennsylvania Thursday a week ago, but vice presidential candidate Mike Pence said, what we have before us, really the choice is two very different futures, because we're talking about constitutionalists or those who say, well, the Constitution is a living document. Mm-hmm. Be careful whenever you hear someone talk about the Constitution being a living document, because in really postmodern epistemology, when people say a living document, you know, the works of Plato are a living document, what that really means is that the meanings of words and the interpretation is completely relative, and I or any succeeding generation can really make it mean whatever they want it to mean. Mm-hmm. The founders framed the documents, including our Constitution, not to be, you know, fluid and relative, but objective and fixed. And so we're talking about...
And they made means by which it could be amended if it needed to be changed, which it needed to be made changed, which is excellent.
Exactly. They did. I mean, our government structure from the beginning, I mean, has been genius. I really believe that. When it's followed, I will say this, Jerry. I remember in the 90s during Bill Clinton's two terms, when Secretary Clinton back then was made an attempt at universal health care. Really, back then in the 90s, they called it socialized medicine. But I remember in the news, she was on record a few times talking about the need for a constitutional convention, whereby we raise the hood, we, you know, get under the hood and turn the wrenches, and anything really is up for grabs. And the idea of a constitutional convention in 2017 or here in the 21st century really troubles me, because it's not the America it was even 20 years ago.
Sure.
I mean, it really isn't. So we're talking about a couple of different futures. We're talking about respect for the rule of law. We're talking about, I know in the debate, she alluded to the national debt when Chris Wallace reminded her that her economic plan could add $18 trillion. Oh, trillion, man. With a T. to an already $20, $21 trillion debt.
Wow.
She said, well, we need to talk about raising the cap. In other words, the debt ceiling. Now, you know, my wife and I, when we find ourselves in a position that we can't afford something, we're just not able to move forward. I mean, we have to live within a budget and live within our means. And to continually raise the debt ceiling just to further encumber the country in an indebtedness that will never be resolved.
Yeah.
That is a horrible way to really end our freedoms.
Sure.
So much is at stake. Federalized education, whereby local school districts are not able to really map out their own curriculum plans. I know during the third and final debate, candidate Clinton talked about a federalized school curriculum that would begin in kindergarten.
Ugh.
And so much is at stake.
See,
about
what would such a curriculum teach about human sexuality? Probably things totally contrary to the Word of God.
And, exactly.
You know, when you were talking about the thing about the two different visions, just let me have here are some actual quotes. This is from the Republican platform. This is related to the issue of life, pro-life. The unborn child, this is a quote from the Republican platform. The unborn child has a fundamental individual right to life which cannot be infringed. Here's the Democratic platform. Quote, every woman should have access to quality reproductive health care services, including safe and legal abortion, regardless of where she lives, how much money she makes, or how she is insured, end of quote. And, of course, part of that is then repealing the Hyde Amendment, which would mean then that we, the taxpayers, would pay for abortion. So, clearly, Hillary Clinton is in the pro-abortion category. I don't see how some Christians somehow let that pass them by, or, you know, they don't grasp that. Hello?
Yeah, exactly. Well, the Democrat Party, and listen, I come from a long line of registered Democrats. My dear grandmother, one of the most godly women I ever knew, and she's been gone 35 years, but she helped raise me, but she was a lifelong Democrat. And I know in the South, and I'm from the South, many of the registered Democrats are what we used to call FDR Democrats, because they, you know, their families, you know, came out of the Depression, and they believed that the Democrat Party was for the little guy, quote unquote. But many godly people that have been lifelong Democrats need to understand that the issue of abortion, which, you know, Secretary Clinton continually calls a woman's right to choose, or it's referred to as health care, for the first time ever, the Democrat Party platform has included the promise to abolish the Hyde Amendment. And in the third and final debate, Ms. Clinton said that she would not restrict any funding for Planned Parenthood because, quote, of all the health care it provides females, that we, and she would say, you know, we're a compassionate people. That's not who we are. We're not going to deny mammograms, and we're not going to deny health care to women. Well, may I remind listeners that I thought that was what the Affordable Care Act was going to do. Planned Parenthood, largely the vast majority, I've read that it's well over 80% of all that they do are abortions.
Wow.
And the Hyde Amendment, they've promised to abolish the Hyde Amendment, which, as you said, restricts, supposedly prohibits federal funding for abortion.
Right.
Although President Obama in January of 2009, you know, his first act once being sworn in, the first thing he did was appropriate some federal money for the performing of abortions on military bases,
wow,
which was actually the violation of a law.
Hmm. All right, so we're basically out of time. Thank you so much for being with us. Certainly there's a lot at stake in this election. AlexMcFarland.com for more information. I guess at the end of the day, Alex, it boils down to which instinct is stronger, the never Trump or the never Hillary. So we need prayer in this nation. I'm sure we all agree on that. AlexMacFarland.com. Thanks, Alex. God bless you.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye.